history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done some pretty remarkable things for the sake of our country. And if we take the time to listen to their stories, we're educated, we're entertained, even inspired by these members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And today we're going to meet a 92-year-old World War II veteran, lives in Orem, Utah, just up the road from where you were born in Provo. Max de St. Jour is our guest today. And Provo, Utah, what was that like when you were a kid growing up with three brothers and three sisters?
A lot of work in the farm.
What did you guys grow?
Beets, sugar beets, alfalfa, just about everything, you know.
I've heard about some of those sugar beet harvests. In fact, there's even a high school in Salt Lake City. They're the beet diggers, because I guess they used to get out of school to harvest the beets.
That's right. They're called the beet diggers, Jordan High, I think.
That's right, and that sounds like hard work.
Yeah, it is. You plant them, then you thin them, and then you hoe them, and you finally harvest them after in the fall when it gets cold and muddy, and it's not a lot of fun.
And you were the third youngest of those seven kids, so I guess you had some older siblings to teach you some of that?
Yeah, I had three older brothers.
And all four of you boys would serve during World War II, and we're going to hear more about that. But I'm always curious to hear from folks who lived through the 1930s. Most of us today can't fathom what it was like during the Great Depression, and it certainly impacted some families more than others. But what do you remember about that time, and did you see the world around you changing a little bit?
Well, it changed, but we were lucky. We were able to harvest most of the food that we needed. You know, we had a lot of hard work, and you'd do anything for a dollar, you know. My dad would do all kinds of work, you know. He was really a hard worker.
Do you remember having some ambitions back then when you were a young boy growing up? Did you have some dreams or some things that you thought you were going to do with your life?
No, my biggest dream is, when do I get off this farm?
And I guess eventually Uncle Sam would take care of that for you, huh?
Yes, I worked in Provo. I worked, my first job was furniture, DTR Furniture it was called, Dixon Taylor Russell Furniture, repairing coal stoves. We used to put new grates and everything in them. That was really a black job. And then me and a buddy of mine went to aviation mechanic school in Salt Lake. And we went to California, and I went to work for Douglas Aircraft as an aircraft mechanic. And I'd done that for a couple of years before I was drafted into service.
Well, a lot of folks working in those aircraft factories had exemptions from the military because their work was vital to the war. Is that something that you could have had if you wanted to have it?
I think I probably could have got a deferment, but there were guys going out of there like crazy, you know, and so it was mostly women.
Yeah, a lot of those aircraft factories had a lot of women working in them. So what kind of planes were you working on there for Douglas?
Mostly I was working on the assembly line where we installed engines in A-20s. That's a medium bomber, two-engine bomber.
Yeah, the old A-20 Havoc. One question I like to ask every veteran who's on this show, because just about every single one has an answer and a pretty clear memory. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you found out that Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, I just got back. I went with some friends of mine up to Bozeman, Montana. And we got back that Sunday morning that's when I found out about it.
Did you hear it on the radio? Were people talking about it at church or running around town? Can you explain that to us?
I think I heard it on the radio. I don't remember for sure, but I'm sure it was on the radio where we heard about it.
And what did that mean at the time? I mean, did it strike you? Did it make an impression, or was it, okay, that's not that big a deal?
Well, I was kind of mad, and I had a buddy, a good friend of mine, that wanted to go to Salt Lake and hunt up some Japs and beat them up. I mean, everybody had that attitude, I think, to a certain extent.
Of the four boys there who served, you and your three brothers were all in the war. Who got into the service first?
My oldest brother. He went with the first draft out of Provo. And my two brothers went in the Navy. They enlisted at the same time. They went through a boot camp together, but they got separated after that. And I was the last one.
So we had one in the Army, two in the Navy, and you ended up in the Army Air Corps. Is that what you wanted?
I tried to get in the Navy, but strange as it may sound, in California, they said the quota was full. So I ended up in the Army Air Corps.
Which I guess fits, since you'd already been working at Douglas and working on these assembly lines. You knew a thing or two about aircraft. Yeah. But most guys I've interviewed who were in the Army Air Corps, they said they really wanted to be pilots. And some of them realized they wouldn't have a chance because of educational requirements and things like that. But was there a part of you that had that dream of being a pilot?
No, I never really had that. I figured I'd be too short-legged. But my real good friend, the one that I went to mechanic school with, he ended up as a B-17 pilot and got his 27 missions in. Then he went for United Airlines, and he worked for them for about 30 years until he had to retire.
Retirement? What's that? You don't know anything about that. You're still working at age 92.
Yeah, I've retired three times, but I keep coming back. It gives me something to do. It keeps me out of mischief.
I guess so. Well, keeping track of your five kids and those three dozen grandkids and great-grandkids and even a couple great-great-grandkids, I'm sure keeps you hopping, too. But none of them would have been here if you didn't make it through World War II. So tell me about when you did end up in the Army Air Corps. What were some of the things that they had you do as they prepared you to head overseas?
They were going to make a ball turret gunner on a B-17 out of me, I guess on account of my size. But when I got overseas, I ended up at this air depot, and they seen, I guess, by MOS, and they seen, well, this guy's got mechanical experience. So I lucked out. I think I've tell everybody that money I spent on that mechanic school was probably the best money I ever spent in my life, because it probably saved my life. Because when I first got over there, we were taking a kicking, you know, losing 200 planes go out on a mission and lose 60 on one day.
And of all the places in the plane to be, one of the most hazardous. Yeah. Was that ball turret for a lot of reasons, as I'm sure you saw firsthand. So yeah, maybe that mechanic school and them reading that on your form, that maybe saved your life, huh?
I'm sure it did. I'm thoroughly convinced it did.
Well, again, I'm sure all those kids and grandkids, all your descendants are pretty thankful for that. So you mentioned Base Air Depot, and we've had some folks on this show before who served at those, and you are at BAD 2. Doesn't mean you're getting into trouble, but that's the abbreviation for Base Air Depot. Tell us where that was and what that was like.
It was in Wharton, England. That's between Preston, England, and Blackpool, England. It was good duty. There was probably 10,000 guys there, and I even have a record here. All the planes we worked on, even the serial numbers of them.
And I'm sure we all want to know what kind of planes you worked on and what were your specific duties there and maybe even how taxing that was, you know, because some guys had some jobs in the service during World War II where it was real intense for a day or two and then they got a break, and other guys it was all day, every day. So maybe you can give us a taste for the specific kind of work you did there.
Well, I was mostly ended up doing just about the same thing I was doing when I worked for Douglas, was installing engines. But we worked on all kinds of B-24s, B-17s, P-51s, P-47s, just about every kind of plane there was. If you had to install an engine on them, you had pretty much instructions on what to do on each one of them, you know.
And these are planes that have already been in action and need new engines, or they're brand new that you're putting together there?
Both, yeah. I mean, we done all kinds of repair work. And also, if there's any modifications on new planes that came in, we would do whatever had to be done on them. And then they had what they called a ferry squadron that would ferry them to different bases wherever they had to go.
Well, let me stay here for now with working on these. Did you have a favorite of all those planes that you worked on? Was there a particular model that you either enjoyed working on the most or you thought that would be the most fun to get up in the air in?
Well, I'm a favorite of the P-51. I really loved it. In fact, I've got to ride in a P-51 twice in my life. I tell everybody that they won the air war in Europe.
That was a lot of guys' favorite plane, and it was crucial in winning that air war. And until the Germans broke out those jets, it was the fastest thing in the sky. And I bet when you were working on those, if you had to install those engines, you probably had to not only use your eyes but your ears, huh? When it comes to that engine, doesn't it have a real distinctive sound when it's going?
Oh yeah, I can tell the sound of a P-51 if I was just in bed. They just have a distinct sound.
And you said you've been in a P-51 twice in your life. Yeah. Were those both after the war? Did you get to get up in one during the war?
One was during the war. We got we had one P-51 that they when they were unloading it off the ship in Liverpool, they dropped it and banged it all up, and so they took it into the salvage yard and was going to use it for spare parts. And the guys talked the old colonel into letting them rebuild it on their own time, and they rebuilt it and put two seats in it, and I got to ride in it. It made all the whiskey runs. After that, it was just a plaything of the base. And then the next time I rode one was, he was a good friend of mine, lived in Heber, it's up northeast of here. He owned one, and I went up with him in that P-51.
Which was a bigger thrill, while the war was going on or while you're back here in the States?
I think it was the one who went with, his name was Russ McDonald, because he really put it through the spins and all that, you know. In fact, my kids, you could ask my daughter here, she could tell you, that's my dad up in that plane. He says, I'm going to do a slow roll. What do you think, Max? And I said, well, go for it. So he did. Are you all right? And I said, yeah, I'm fine. He says, well, I'll do a couple more.
Did you hold everything down?
Yeah, he says, he's a screamer. He's not a barfer.
Yeah, I don't know if I would be able to say the same for myself in those circumstances. So you get over there to England in 1943, and as you mentioned, at this point in the war, air superiority really belonged to the enemy. I mean, the Luftwaffe was shooting down American planes, the anti-artillery was heavy. I imagine you saw some planes come into your base in some pretty bad shape.
Yeah, in fact, I was amazed at some of them. You wonder how they could keep flying, especially the B-17. They could take a lot of abuse.
Did you guys have to do any of the body work, too, or just the engine work?
I didn't get in on any body work, but it all depended on what department you were in, you know, what your job was. I never got any sheet metal work or anything like that. It was mostly all engine work.
And when you're working on these planes and you see what the planes have been through, and then you think about the guys who were in the plane when it was going through that, I imagine you have some pretty good perspective about the men, teenagers, guys in their young 20s, who were flying those planes. How do you feel about the guys who flew all those missions?
They had a lot of guts, I'll tell you. I don't know what the life expectancy was on them, but they were losing a lot of them. In fact, I had a good friend that got shot down, and I told him, I always had a fear of having to bail out, you know. And he says, well, I'll tell you something. If those flames start licking in your rear end, you'll jump.
Not something you want to have to find out firsthand, but so many of them did during World War II. So many questions come to mind, and with regard to the work you're doing on these engines, and maybe it seems a little mundane to you because that's what you've always done, but I imagine there were some cases that were a bigger challenge than others, and some that instruction manual isn't going to give you all the answers, and you had to improvise a little bit. Can you think of any stories like that where you came up with a creative fix that you felt good about?
No, I don't remember anything like that. You had plenty of supervisors, you know, that had more knowledge than you did, but it could help you if you run into a problem.
Did you get a kick out of some of the nose art that those planes had?
Oh, yeah, I got quite a few of them in this book here I'm going to show you. Can you just see them doing that nowadays?
I don't think it would last very. It would be a little different caliber, I suppose. Although if you watch television, it's probably worse than all the nose art. What about life in that spot with all these other Americans who are over here in England? How did you guys get along with each other, and how did you interact with the Brits around there?
I loved the British people. They were, I think they realized that we were saving them, you know. I really liked the British people. In fact, I even had some of them coming and stay here at my house after, and I got along good with all the guys I worked with, you know. They were just a good bunch of guys.
What'd you do on your downtime? Did you get yourself into any trouble?
No, I didn't get any trouble, but we used to go to Blackpool and, you know, the dances and stuff like that, but I never did get any trouble. I could have. I'm sure there was times when I could have, but I lucked out.
Where you were, and, you know, you're not flying the missions. You're not on the front lines in the infantry like your brother was. You're not on a ship like your other brothers were. But did you ever feel like the spot you were in was a dangerous place to be and that you guys could be targeted there?
Oh, yeah. I can't figure out how we did get bombed because our air base was just wall-to-wall planes. But we did have a real disaster.
Well, hold that thought because I don't want to cut that story short, but it's break time for now. When we come back, 92-year-old Max de St. Jour will tell us about the day tragedy hit Base Air Depot 2 in England. And remember, he had three brothers serving in the war. We're going to find out how Max learned one of those brothers would not be coming home to Utah. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.